going to target certain minorities for punishment. I mean, whether it's going to be people who look like Mexicans who'll be targeted by ICE agents, or it will be, you know, vigilante groups out there shooting Indians, going after Muslims, etc. I think we are on the precipice of some kind of race war. And unless the great resistance that is building up in the country recognizes this fully and confronts it fully, I think this could be a very dangerous period for the United States.
Well, we're going to leave it right there. We thank you for taking the time out to speak with us, Vijay Prashad. We urge people to check out all of your work. I want to let people know that you are based at Trinity College in Hartford, professor of international studies, author of many excellent books, and we thank you for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thanks a lot. My pleasure. Bye, Dennis.
Bye-bye now.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein. The screening is Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center. Gaining Ground is a film about growing food, empowering communities, and changing lives. It also addresses the negative impacts of industrial agriculture and genetically modified foods. It is an intimate view of rural and urban farmers embracing challenges. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center, Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 934 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 11:01 a.m. Coming up on Between the Lines Radio, a 40-year history of radical activism and useful lessons for today's Trump resistance movements. And at 11:30, Making Contact looks at reclaiming public schools, major changes in state curriculum, and where schools nationwide may be headed under Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Thanks again to all the KBOO members for your generous and ongoing support. For those who have not yet become members of the KBOO Foundation, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. You click on the word donate. That's all coming up, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, who assesses the winners and losers in the proposed Republican Party health care plan. An excerpt of a speech by Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakama Nation in Washington State, delivered at the Native Nations Rise March and Rally in Washington, D.C. And L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics, who talks about her new book titled Direct Action, which offers useful lessons for today's Trump resistance movement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The smiling face of Donald Trump fills a billboard in the Serb-majority town of North Mitrovica, Kosovo. Serbs, who are a minority in Kosovo, were elated when Trump beat Hillary Clinton in last November's election. Many still hate Bill Clinton, who, as U.S. president in the 1990s, led bombing campaigns against Serb military forces in Bosnia and Kosovo during the violent breakup of the former Yugoslavia. Since a peace deal was signed in the Balkans, new ethnic tensions have resurfaced amid calls to reopen debate over borders and potential land swaps. In Bosnia, the autonomous Serb Republic regularly threatens to hold a referendum for independence. According to the Guardian newspaper, some Bosnian Serbs have supported the idea of boycotting the central government in Sarajevo, which has not accepted a ruling by the International Court of Justice, clearing Serbia of complicity in genocide during the Bosnian War. Conflicts between Albanians and Serbs never ended in the Balkans. One human rights activist observed, It's Israel and Palestine in Europe. Western diplomats now worry 2017 may become a nightmare year with elections in Serbia and the growing likelihood of a snap poll in Kosovo. Indictments are also expected from a special court in The Hague, adjudicating crimes committed by members of the Kosovo Liberation Army, whose leaders now serve in Kosovo's political establishment. The U.S. Export-Import Bank has provided $315 million in financing to the New Jersey-based Connell Company, which sold equipment to mines in Africa accused of exploiting slave labor and of committing other human rights abuses. The financing deals from 2007 to 2015 involved 17 mining companies in sub-Saharan Africa. The Connell Company used U.S. taxpayer financing to supply equipment to the Bisha copper mine in Eritrea, which is under investigation by a Canadian court over accusations of using slave labor. The Canadian mining company Nevsun Resources, which runs the Bisha mine, faces a class action suit claiming Nevsun used the army to force military conscripts to work in their mine. The Connell Company, a family-owned conglomerate founded in 1926, is one of the largest recipients of financing from the Export-Import Bank, along with banking giants like Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the Connell Company donated almost $5.8 million to U.S. politicians from 1990 to 2016. After Donald Trump was nominated for president, Virginia activist Brittany Scherer decided it was time to commit to running for the state Senate. Scherer, an academic advisor at Old Dominion College, is not alone. Young women have flooded political training programs since Trump was elected in November, many concerned about reproductive rights and climate change. The new wave of feminist political activism comes just in time for the Democratic Party, which has lost control of the majority of state houses across the country. The current enthusiasm of women interested in running for local office is similar to what occurred in 1992, when the number of women candidates surged after the sexual harassment claims against Supreme Court Justice nominee Clarence Thomas were dismissed by the majority of the U.S. Senate. The number of women in public office has grown since the 1990s, but has flattened out in recent years. According to the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University, women make up just 19% of the seats in Congress and only 25% of all state legislators. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Donald Trump and Republican Party leaders in the House and Senate have followed through on their campaign pledge to repeal and replace Obamacare. But the proposed GOP legislation, dubbed the American Health Care Act, shamelessly fails to live up to Trump's repeated promises on the campaign trail to provide health insurance to all Americans, ensure that all Americans will have quality health care for less money than Obamacare, and to never cut funding for Medicaid. On all three of those important pledges, the Republican health care bill flunks. Analysis of the legislation by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projects that 24 million more Americans would be uninsured by 2026 than under Obamacare, including 14 million that would lose their insurance by 2018. While the GOP bill would lower federal deficits by $337 billion over 10 years, largely as a result of cuts to Medicaid that would reduce enrollment, average health insurance premiums would rise by as much as 20% in 2018 and 2019 before falling in later years. If the Republican health care plan were to become law, an estimated 52 million people would be uninsured by 2026, compared to 28 million who lack insurance under the current law. More than 50 national organizations oppose the GOP's proposed health care plan endorsed by President Trump, including AARP, the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, the Federation of American Hospitals, in the American Cancer Society. Your reporter spoke with Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and an economic advisor to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign. Here, Friedman assesses the winners and losers of the proposed Republican Party health care plan.
Well, the plan could very well be seen as wealth care instead of health care. The one definite element in the Republican plan that has persisted throughout all the various permutations is that they're going to repeal all the taxes that fund the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. And these are taxes that most people do not know about because they're only assessed on people earning over $250,000 a year. So they're getting rid of all the taxes, which is about $500 billion over the next decade. And all of that money is going to the top 1% of American households, most of it going to the top 1/100th of 1%. So those people are getting a lot of money. Now, since you're getting rid of the revenue, you have to find ways to cut spending. And they're doing it by doing away with the subsidies associated with the Affordable Care Act, subsidies that have gone to working people. They go to people earning less than four times the poverty line, which gets up to like $70,000 for families. And most of the subsidies go to people earning much, much less than that. Second, they are saving money by starting in 2020, basically phasing out the Medicaid expansion program that was part of the Affordable Care Act that mostly blue states, but a few Republican-dominated states, expanded Medicaid to cover people up to 140%, 138% of the poverty line, and also did away with all sorts of restrictions on Medicaid. And those two measures, the subsidies for people to buy individual health insurance plans and the Medicaid expansion, account for the dramatic drop in the proportion of Americans without health insurance. At this point, over 90% of Americans have health insurance. So the Affordable Care Act has worked to extend health insurance to people through subsidies for people to buy individual plans and Medicaid expansion, and those are both to be eliminated. The subsidies go right away, and the Medicaid expansion after 2020. Also, while they're doing this, things get even worse because they will be pulling the rug out from the whole market structure that's been set up. The Affordable Care Act, by subsidizing people to buy health insurance and requiring that people have health insurance, although that's a requirement that has never been enforced, has established a market for individual health insurance, for people to buy health insurance as individuals. That's a market that pretty much did not exist before, because health insurance companies would look at people like, why do you want to buy health insurance as an individual? It must be that you expect that you're going to be sick. The health insurance companies are ready to walk away from the individual marketplaces if there are no subsidies and no mandate. The Congressional Budget Office, they're all Republicans over there now. The Republicans took over the House and Senate a couple years ago, and they have full control over the Congressional Budget Office. So it's an old Bush administration economist. I'm sure he's competent, but their bias has been to downplay how bad this law is.
A quick question for you.
Yeah.
Several years ago, Dr. Steffi Wollhandler and David Himmelstein did a study that they published that talked about some 43,000 people would die if Obamacare was repealed, because although there's lots of criticism to go around about the Obamacare system, it essentially gave people insurance and access to preventive health care and saved lives. Do we have any idea what will happen if 24 million people lose their insurance by 2026 under this Republican plan? How many people would lose their lives?
Yeah, going back to the original study that Wollhandler, Himmelstein, and Wilper at Harvard Public Health did, I think it was 2003. I'm not totally sure of the year. But anyway, the original study, you'd basically figure 1,000 people die for every million people who lose health insurance. So if you have 24 million people thrown off health insurance, you'd be expecting about 24,000 more or less extra deaths in 2026. You'd expect 14,000 extra deaths next year. You know, put it in perspective, that's more than the number of Americans who died in 1967 in the Vietnam War. And we'd be doing that every year. People have to think about that, you know, in Congress. You know, how many Americans are you willing to kill?
I wanted to ask you about the possibility that this debacle in healthcare could result in some newfound political energy and popular support for Medicare for all, a single-payer system. Are you optimistic we are going to find ourselves moving towards single-payer in this country anytime soon?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, for two reasons. The first is the public energy, the resistance energy that's building up against the Trump administration and against the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And second, destroying the Affordable Care Act is showing that we really need to do something dramatic to improve, to salvage health care in America.
That was Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Find more analysis of the proposed Republican health care plan and the single-payer alternative by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 10th, thousands of indigenous people from across the U.S. gathered in Washington, D.C. for the Native Nations Rise March and Rally. The action was preceded by 2 days of prayer and ceremony on the National Mall. The march route went past the Trump International Hotel, where some participants had erected a teepee, and a group of women did a circle dance. The event began as rain turned to snow, and then back to rain, which was described as Mother Earth doing exactly what she's supposed to be doing by a representative of the Piscataway Nation who welcomed everyone to her homeland. The days of protest and prayer were organized by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which continues to fight the Dakota Access Pipeline, as well as the Indigenous Environmental Network and the Native Organizers Alliance. Participants carried banners opposing the Dakota Pipeline, as well as signs calling for Native consent, and not just consultation, for invasive projects on their lands. Following an executive order from Donald Trump, the Dakota Access Pipeline is now proceeding to completion under the Missouri River, but the tribe is still engaged in a court fight to stop it. One of the speakers at a rally across from the White House was Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakima Nation in Washington State. He read from a proclamation signed by the Yakima and the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which opposes what it calls the doctrine of Christian discovery that justifies the invasion and exploitation of Native lands and peoples.
We carry a message and a warning here today. Love the earth. Love the waters of the earth. Love all forms of life. Care for them with deep and abiding honor and respect, and they will sustain you throughout time. However, be forewarned, if you poison and destroy them, they will poison and destroy you. That is natural law. Our ancestors bequeathed to us a sacred birthright of pure, pristine, and healing waters. Their prayerful and ceremonial manner of caring for the earth resulted in the purest rivers, springs, streams, and aquifers in the respective territories of our nations throughout this hemisphere. Our ancestors used their natural and innate intelligence to discern that water provides life force, the spirit upon all which life depends here on Mother Earth. Our ancestors were given and further evolved original instruction, natural laws, and wisdom teachings. Those instructions included the warning, remember, we follow in a prayerful manner these ceremonial and spiritual patterns of thought and behavior enable us to maintain a sacred and right relationship with the natural abundance of Mother Earth, interconnected with all life forms for all future generations. This is our life-sustaining message today. For more than 500 years, however, contrary forces of greed has worked to destroy our natural laws and our love for Mother Earth. They have greatly opposed our nations, our ceremonies, our teachings, and our sacred places in the name and in the idea that they call Christendom in Western Europe. The U.S. Supreme Court rulings and other U.S. actions have expressed these opposing forces, claiming a right of Christian sovereignty and dominion over the territories of the nations based upon the idea that Christian nations of Europe acquire jurisdiction over lands over heathens and infidels. The U.S. Justice Department made that exact argument in the U.S. Supreme Court case in 1954, Teton Indians versus the United States. The Justice Department even quoted Genesis 1:28 and the Book of Psalms from the Bible to support the claim of right Christian supremacy. This is a direct contradiction with the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the separation of church and state. We reject the pattern of thought and behavior premised on the Credo and Command, love riches and wealth, the Vatican Papal documents, and the colonizing royal charters written by self-described Christian monarchs that brought the Credo and Command here reveal the underlying code of domination and dehumanization used to attack our nations. The code of domination expressed a belief system that is willing to sacrifice everything on the altar of greed, even the sacred waters upon which life depends. To realize the unfortunate truth of this statement, one has to only think of the lead in the brains of the children of Flint, Michigan, where greed and disrespect for life destroyed rivers that once ran so pure you could drink from them, when our indigenous ancestors prayerfully cared for them since time immemorial. The government and corporate forces that oppose us have a great disdain for our organic laws and teachings, because the laws and teachings stand in the way of them fulfilling their love of riches and wealth. Those forces that oppose us are blind to the spiritual nature and the healing qualities of water. For them, water is simply a commodity, a means to create more riches and wealth, or a commodity to waste and destroy in search of riches and wealth. Therefore, we stand here today and offer the following statement as a proclamation. From the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the Yakima Nation, we will read this forth and we will call upon all Native nations and all original and free nations of this earth to stand and sign on to this proclamation with us. The original proclamation of life, original nations proclamation. We understand that our Creator has uniquely brought forth our existence. Our creation is of free and original origin, grounded in love and sustained by divine instruction, resulting in an existence and awareness that has materialized since time immemorial on Turtle Island. We understand the ideas of domination and dehumanization, as these ideas are referenced within the divine instructions and warnings we have heeded since time immemorial for our sustained existence as original free peoples and nations. We understand that the inaccurate concept of discovery, formerly referred to as the doctrine of discovery, utilized by the monarchies of Spain and England, have unjustly manifested the idea of domination and dehumanization against our original free peoples and nations. We understand that the doctrine of discovery by historical monarchies was justified by unholy instruction issued by writ of papal bulls. We understand the dominating and dehumanizing force of manifest destiny utilized in the executive, legislative, and judicial formation of America. We understand the specific reference of the flawed and unholy idea of the doctrine of discovery in the origin of federal Indian law, cited in the Johnson versus McIntosh ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1823 and reaffirmed in 1955 by the Supreme Court ruling Teton Indians versus United States. We understand the judicial precedent of the unchallengeable domination that is being utilized by America's judicial, executive, and legislative branches in the modern-day disputes with original and free peoples and nations, such as Standing Rock's fight with the advocacy of clean water. We understand that the negative ideas of domination and dehumanization warned about to our collective original free peoples and nations by and through divine instruction is the same negative idea that has been utilized by the Roman Catholic Church, the monarchies of Spain and England, and the United States of America.
That was Joe Day Gowdy, chairman of the Yakima Nation. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more information on the Native Nations Rise Action and organized indigenous resistance by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 1960s and early 70s was a period of great turmoil and change in the U.S. and around the world. While the decade of the 1950s was identified with conformity and repression, symbolized by Senator Joe McCarthy's anti-communist witch hunts, the 1960s saw a blossoming of powerful social movements. Among these was the critical struggle against racism and for civil rights, massive protests to end America's wars in Southeast Asia, and the birth of new movements for women's equality and the coming out of the LGBT community. A new book, titled Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism by L.A. Kaufman, captures the voices of activists and leaders from a wide range of movements that have roots in the 1960s and 70s. The book traces the links between these radical movements over four decades and the evolution of strategies and tactics they employed to change the national debate and transform America. Importantly, Direct Action also highlights the central role of women and queer organizers, as well as the enduring racial divisions that have shaped progressive activism. Your reporter spoke with L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics for more than 30 years, about the history covered in her new book, which she explains offers many useful lessons for today's Trump resistance movement.
When I look at the history of these movements and these organizing traditions unfolding over the course of this 40-year period, I see time and time again that the people who have functioned as the bridges between movements, who have brought the skills and the tactics and the organizing techniques, including some of the ones like affinity groups and spokes councils and consensus decision making, the people who have carried that knowledge and those practices from movement to movement have been disproportionately women and disproportionately queer women. And that is just an observation based on decades of being in movements, of who, if you look at the through lines from the anti-nuclear movement to the Central America work and then to ACT UP, for instance, most of the men in ACT UP were political novices. It was the lesbians in ACT UP who were the folks who had done Central America work or who had been part of the women's peace encampments and brought all of these organizing skills. And so I think it's very fitting that as I say, it was kind of the kickoff party or the coming out for the resistance, the Women's March, which was, really a decentralized mobilization. People really self-mobilized. It had many different voices in it and is led by women. I've been incredibly, repeatedly surprised by the breadth and scope of the resistance that's emerging now. We're obviously facing an unprecedented challenge, but the scale and character of what I'm seeing is so different from anything I've seen in decades. It's so much broader. It's so much kind of livelier. It's coming in from so many unexpected quarters that although we're facing challenges like I've never seen, I feel encouraged that our movements are going to continue to resist strongly as Trump attempts to implement his policies and are going to be thinking very strategically about 2018 and 2020 and the longer road ahead.
In terms of the challenges for the Trump resistance movement, it seems that keeping up the high energy and the just incredible momentum that has built up in these last couple of months is difficult, is certainly a challenge, as well as sustaining that movement and that energy over the long haul. Do you have any advice for activists and organizers about the lessons that you've taken away from your living and working through the history of these last 40 years of radical movements?
Well, obviously people need to pace themselves and think about self-care and be judicious in not burning themselves out in the short run. But there are times that require more of us, that ask us to do more and stretch ourselves farther. I think people are already doing that, and I think that's what we have to continue doing. We know that protest movements can be quite effective, and right now, civil society is the only check on the Trump administration, really, that there is. So I encourage people to, yes, be thoughtful about their participation so they can think about the long run, but to understand that these are such extraordinary times that it's a time for all of us to see what we can do to stretch ourselves and be a little bolder and really persist, because that's what victories come from.
That was L.A. Kaufman, a veteran organizer, strategist, journalist, and observer of U.S. radical politics for more than 30 years, talking about her new book titled Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. Find links to Kaufman's website and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
On March 17th, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m., from the grassroots, where we agitate for social change, with music and commentary, we will honor Her Majesty, the Queen of Soul. She plans on retiring this year, and her birthday is March 25th. So let us honor Her Majesty, the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, on Friday, March 17th, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland.
This week on Making Contact.
This is what's happening in education, right? High-stakes testing, narrowing the curriculum, marketizing and privatizing education. All of these things are interlinked not only here in the United States, but around the world. There's a point of hope, which is that communities and the professions are really fighting back.
Access to a quality education means different things to different people. Some families are willing and able to pay top dollar for a private school. Other children are homeschooled, while many rely on public schools for their education. And some students are calling for a more thorough and inclusive curriculum in the legislature and in the classroom.
You know, it's not a great feeling to feel like you have to educate your educators, and that's not something I should have to do, and it's not something I want to do.
On this edition of Making Contact, we look at two major changes to the statewide curriculum in California and ask where schools nationwide might be headed under Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. California has retooled its course offerings by developing ethnic studies and LGBT studies. In some states, it's illegal for teachers to say positive things about LGBT people. California, however, has passed multiple laws in recent years that do just the opposite and actively include LGBT communities in the public school curricula. But just because it's the law doesn't mean it's actually happening yet. Reporter Hannah Harris-Green visited a middle school in Los Angeles where teachers are using the new curriculum.
It's Ally Week at Thomas Starr King Middle School in Los Angeles. That means a week of activities devoted to making LGBTQ students feel safe. Matthew French is teaching his sixth grade health class a lesson entitled Diversity and Human Relationships.
Aside from the fact that the state includes all of this in what you're supposed to learn anyway, to me, one of the biggest motivations in teaching it to you, and especially now during Ally Week, is this word up here, homophobia. So when we think about the reasons that people discriminate against other people, bully them, harass them, hate them, whatever, we have names for that. So for example, if somebody is against you because of your race, that's racism.
Just because I'm racist.
In this case,
just because I was born
in this case,
The students feel comfortable with French, but they respect him also. Sometimes they get a little rowdy, banging on tables and talking all at once, but they're engaged, and when French tells them to be quiet, they listen. He feels comfortable with them, too. They ask him questions about when he was a teenager, a closeted high schooler in Arizona, and he answers them.
At my high school, there were more than 3,000 students. More than 3,000. And here at King, we have, what, 2,100? So a lot. So over 3,000 students, and there wasn't a single person on the whole campus, a student, teacher, administrator, no one that was out. So does that mean there were no gay people at my school?
No.
So how come I didn't know a single other gay person?
Because they were in the closet.
Yeah, so I mean, we presume that, you know, that we were all hiding in a sense. Why do you think that's the case? Out of 3,000 people, that all those people that might have been in LGBT plus would not have been out?
Because they were worried that nobody else would support them or back them up. And so people are feared that they won't be able to actually express themselves without being made fun of.
Somebody connect that for me to...
A lot of effort went into making a classroom like this one possible. The California State Legislature passed several policies over the last few years to make public schools more inclusive. These include provisions to allow trans students to use the bathrooms and locker rooms, as well as join sports teams that match their gender, a policy which Obama enforced nationally through an executive order. Trump repealed the order after a month in office, but California's state law still stands. California has also passed laws requiring inclusive curriculums in health and social science classes. The FAIR Act, passed in 2011, requires history and social science classes to include the contributions of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals, as well as people with disabilities. Don Romisberg helped create the curriculum textbook companies and teachers will follow in order to comply with the law. He's a queer studies and history professor at Sonoma State University in Northern California.
When the California Department of Education came out with its first suggested revisions for the new framework, the only places where they put LGBT material was a mention of Harvey Milk in fourth grade California history, and then another mention of Harvey Milk and activist Cleve Jones, as well as gay marriage in 11th grade U.S. history. And we were surprised because LGBT history goes back to the beginning of the nation, before that even, and extends all the way through to the present.
The law requiring inclusive health classes is relatively new. It came into effect in early 2016. But the FAIR Act passed more than 5 years ago, and at least one student has been waiting that whole time for a change.
Hi, my name is Cal Larish. I go to Washington High School. I'm 17 years old, and I use they, them pronouns.
Cal identifies as queer, gender non-binary, and gender fluid. They started working with student LGBTQ organizations to lobby for the FAIR Act before they even started high school. At that age, they had never heard about other queer people in class. And even after the FAIR Act passed, it wasn't until their junior year that a teacher brought up queer history at all, and the teacher didn't say much.
I feel a responsibility sort of to bring this up in a classroom setting sometimes. I brought it up my freshman year when we were talking about sex ed. I brought it up my junior year, so we more explicitly talked about what went on in the Stonewall riots and in the AIDS crisis and the movements that sprang up because of that. And, you know, it's not a great feeling to feel like you have to educate your educators, and that's not something I should have to do, and it's not something I want to do.
A more in-depth change is coming. Romisberg and others who helped lobby for the FAIR Act realized the initial changes weren't enough.
The inclusion that we were pushing for was basically to say, let's make the FAIR Education Act real by putting LGBT history into K-12 education all across the curriculum. I was working with an organization called the Committee on LGBT History, which is an affiliate of the American Historical Association. And we took the old framework and handed out parts of it to experts in early American history, in California history, Native American history, history of slavery and freedom, and so on. We were surprised to learn that this was not common practice. We
had really gone sort of above and beyond in terms of the amount of scholarly justification that we were putting forward to propose our changes. And I think that that good faith effort at the beginning was part of our success because we saw about half of our changes make it in.
This curriculum matters to Rummersburg. Studies show that schools where students learn about LGBTQ people have less bullying and better climates. But Rummersburg is a historian and is equally passionate about making sure that the material is accurate.
It's absolutely essential that when we teach about the past, we aren't teaching about diversity just for the sake of inclusion, but because of accuracy. And a great example of this is in 11th grade. Most people teach McCarthyism, and they teach about sort of Cold War paranoia about communism in the 1950s and how an overreach by the federal government destroyed many lives. What a lot of people don't even know is that there was a far more expansive federal persecution, what historians have dubbed the Lavender Scare, that went from the late 1940s through the early 1970s, and nearly 10,000 people lost their jobs, were pushed out of government, oftentimes lost families, some committed suicide. So this is a story that is part of our civil society and a cautionary tale, like Japanese internment, like McCarthyism, that should absolutely be taught. It's also essential to teach the Lavender Scare because it helps explain why LGBT people in the 1950s and 1960s began to see themselves as a political minority that needed to fight for their civil rights.
As students get ready for the bell to ring, Matthew French reminds them to contribute to a mural out in the courtyard, constructed for Ally Week. He manages to throw in a sly jab at Trump's proposed wall, and the students go wild for it.
Just a reminder, all week this week is Ally Week, so you will be seeing events. At the end of the week, what they're doing is they're building a wall of love, of love. On this wall, you can write a statement or a commitment of love, of support, of being an ally.
But these laws don't mean that every classroom in California is automatically as open as French's. Rummersburg acknowledges that not every teacher will embrace the new material, but he hopes that in those cases, students will demand that their teachers educate them.
In a perfect world, all students should be able to have access to the LGBT past in elementary school, middle school, and high school. And that should just be a matter of fact in the way that the LGBT community is a matter of fact of the U.S. nation state. Unfortunately, LGBT people have always had to fight for our right to exist and for a place at the table and for a voice in our community. And so, I wish students didn't have to fight for that. But now at least they have a really powerful tool to wage that battle. And it may not feel like so much of a fight. It might feel more like a dialogue where once students are empowered with this framework and with this law, they'll be able to advocate on their own behalf and educators will join their struggle.
No matter what the law says, some aspects of every student's education are up to chance. Even in blue states like California, there are places where anti-LGBTQ prejudice runs deep. There are teachers who feel uncomfortable talking about queer people, especially to younger students. But now, California teachers who want to teach about queer history have the law on their side, and so do students who want to learn about it.
That segment was produced by Hannah Harris-Green in Los Angeles. As was mentioned earlier in the program, even though curriculum changes make it into the law books, it doesn't mean they're suddenly being taught in the classroom. The same could be said for the development of ethnic studies curriculums in California, where the field was first developed at colleges and universities in the 1960s and 70s. Jose Lara is a social studies teacher and the dean at Santee Education Complex. It's a high school just south of downtown Los Angeles. Lara is also part of a statewide coalition of students, educators, and parents who worked to pass a model statewide ethnic studies curriculum that would be available by June 30th, 2019. Lara is also a school board member at El Rancho Unified School District and one of the founders of the Ethnic Studies Now Coalition. I asked him how he first came to advocate for the curriculum changes.
myself and a couple of real progressive, social justice oriented educators got elected to the board, and we said, hey, you know what? Ethnic studies shouldn't be something that's only offered as an elective. It should be something mandatory for all students. So we actually passed a resolution and made ethnic studies a graduation requirement in the El Rancho Unified School District. So in El Rancho, you can take classes like gender and ethnicity in literature and film, Chicano mural art. You can take multicultural literature. So there's different classes that students get to choose from in the field of ethnic studies that fits their needs and fits what they're interested in and teachers are passionate about. In San Francisco, they followed a little different model. In San Francisco, they created one specific ethnic studies course that really supported students who were really falling behind. And they've shown dramatic gains, and research has recently shown students go up by a whole grade. GPAs go up by a whole grade point, attendance increases for students taking the ethnic studies courses in the San Francisco Unified School District. So it's different. It looks a little bit different in different districts, but the way we really got started was it started in El Rancho as graduation requirements. We started a grassroots campaign in local districts across the state of California, really connecting with local groups through our network and our website, ethnicstudiesnow.com, really did a grassroots effort to have similar resolutions like the one that passed in El Rancho Unified, passed in Los Angeles, Sacramento, San Francisco, San Diego, Long Beach, and each location entered and developed ethnic studies in a way that fit their needs and their talents and their expertise inside of their district. Very few school districts actually had ethnic studies. Those that did expanded them. Some districts made it mandatory. Other districts established the first programs in the field of ethnic studies. And each place is really responsive to their own regional or local needs. So it looks a little bit different in different parts of California. It all has the same basic strands of looking at race, gender, ethnicity, intersectionality through a lens of power and power dynamics. It has an emphasis on social justice. It has an emphasis of telling calorie narratives and stories not typically found in your standard curriculum. And allows students to be, especially students of color, to be at the center of the curriculum instead of the margins. And it also includes local history, which is absolutely amazing. So it looks a little bit different in different places because local history and context changes from place to place throughout the state of California.
State law says that the Instructional Quality Commission will develop the model curriculum and the Board of Education will encourage districts to offer it in high schools. But statewide, it's not a graduation requirement. How has that been playing out at the district level?
So there are some districts that are going the requirement route. There's other districts that are making it mandatory that they're offered at every single school site. So it looks different in different places. And there's an argument, should you make it mandatory or should you not make it mandatory? So different people have different opinions on that. But we all agree on one thing, that we should be expanding our ethnic studies programs in the state of California.
What have been some of the challenges in the implementation of ethnic studies in public high schools?
So some of the challenges have been school districts really understanding what ethnic studies is. School district officials don't have a concept of what the curriculum looks like. There's been a challenge finding teachers who are well-versed in ethnic studies. You have the credential to teach it, but if you don't have the background in the curriculum, it makes it a little bit more difficult. So training has been a challenge. We have gone pushback on budgetary issues and local priorities. So there's a lot of people will be supportive of ethnic studies, but that's not one of their main district's priorities at this time. And so we tried to make a local push to say this should be a priority. Having students' lives centered in education, having them see themselves in a curriculum is just as important as the math class that you're taking, as the English book that you're taking, and just as importantly, the new Common Core standards actually support what we're trying to do in ethnic studies. Because they're skill-based, not content-based, you can use any content to teach those skills. And so what we're saying is that you can teach reading using almost any book. Why not use one by authors of color? Why not use one reflective of the student lives that you're teaching in? And so as public school teachers, we teach the students that walk through the door. Those are our students. That's our clientele. And more increasingly, they're students of color. But when they're not in our textbooks and the stories of their experiences are not in our books, in our curriculum, there's something gravely missing. We're telling our students that their lives and their stories and their histories and their art, their music, their beauty isn't important to us. And that's the wrong message that we should be sending to students. We should be sending that their lives matter, that they're important, that they're part of our community, and that they're part of the rich tapestry that creates, you know, this country. And so that's what we're really pushing for when we say we want ethnic studies now.
That was Jose Lara, founder of the Ethnic Studies Now Coalition in Los Angeles. You are listening to Making Contact. Thanks to generous support from listeners like you, this program is offered for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcast, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Coming up, we'll hear from a former dean of education at the University of San Francisco on where national education policy could be headed. The state of California is making strides in creating more thorough and inclusive curricula with ethnic studies and LGBT studies. But education policy nationally could be moving in a different direction. Making Contact producer Marie Che spoke with Professor Kevin Kumashiro, founder of Education Deans for Justice and Equity.
Within a week of President Donald Trump's inauguration, members of Congress introduced HB 610, the Choices in Education Act. The bill would take federal money that goes to the schools and communities that need it the most and require states to implement voucher programs that allow parents to use it for private schools, religious schools, or homeschooling. Kevin Kumashiro is former dean of education at the University of San Francisco and founder of Education Deans for Justice and Equity. He says whether or not this particular bill passes, it's a harbinger of what's to come under President Donald Trump and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos.
What we're hearing, both in terms of rhetoric and in terms of proposed policies, are really going to be quite destructive to public education. They are about doing away with the federal role in advancing civil rights in education. It's about using funds to fuel the privatization of public schools. But a lot of the things that we're hearing currently at the federal level are actually not brand new. I mean, in some ways, what we're seeing with Trump and Betsy DeVos, the new Secretary of Education, it might be shocking to some, but it's actually building on decades and even the most recent years under the Obama administration to move us towards marketizing and privatizing public education, to move us towards more school choice, to in some ways overregulate, to in some ways underregulate. So I think this is our challenge, is when we try to name the landscape, we need to actually recognize that there's a history that brought us here and that the picture is incredibly complex.
That history takes us to 1965. The civil rights movement was winning the battle of ideas, and in response, Lyndon Johnson had declared a war on poverty. A key part of it was passing the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, or the ESEA.
And now, within the past 3 weeks, the House of Representatives, by a vote of 263 to 153, and the Senate, by a vote of 73 to 18, have passed the most sweeping educational bill ever to come before Congress. It represents a major new commitment of the federal government to quality and equality in the schooling that we offer our young people.
That bill created the framework for how the federal government would engage in education.
So when we study the history of U.S. schooling, of public schools in the United States, we tend to break up into periods, you know, chunks of time. And there's a period from around the 1950s to the 1980s that many historians call the federal era in U.S. schooling. And it's called the federal era because that's the decades when the federal government began to assert a lot more influence over public education. It wasn't really about micromanaging. It wasn't about telling states and districts everything that they need to do. It was a very specific role that they were playing, and that is to advance civil rights by leveraging federal funds to push states and districts to comply. So what characterizes a lot of what was happening, particularly in the 60s and 70s, was a series of federal legislation that was doing exactly that. It was basically compelling states and local districts to follow civil rights, non-discrimination legislation and principles by leveraging federal funding as kind of the carrot or the incentive. So Elementary and Secondary Education Act, it's addressing, in Title I, it's addressing students Immigrants in Poverty. Title III, it's addressing English language learners. And you have the Bilingual Education Act, you have the Higher Education Act, you have the Civil Rights Act, you have the what eventually became the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And all of these are really the federal government saying, we need to recognize that public schools are falling short in serving some of the most underserved of populations. And so our role is to come in and direct federal funding to try to address the populations that are most falling through the cracks. And this is what I think is so concerning about the recent movement by the federal government.
In 2001, No Child Left Behind was enacted. On the one hand, it reauthorized the ESEA. But on the other, it shifted the role that the federal government would play in education.
I was saying earlier that there's this period from the 50s to the 80s called the federal period. Okay, well, historians also call the period from the 80s till today the standards-based reform period or the standards and accountability period. And it's because there are ideas that emerged, particularly from some of the foundational entities of the conservative and neoliberal movements, like the Business Roundtable, right, the top 300 CEOs of corporations from the United States, that have turned their attention to public education policy. And what then became influential from the Reagan administration, really right up until now, is this idea that the way you improve education is you delineate, you articulate a set of standards, and then you hold schools accountable for meeting those standards as measured by these really narrow standardized tests. And so high-stakes decision-making increasingly became a centerpiece of federal policy and therefore of national policy. And so we were moving in this direction, this kind of narrow way of thinking about, I mean, who can argue with having high standards? But you can argue with narrowly defining what those standards are and how we measure and then what the consequences are. It became this very narrow test and punish kind of policy that really you see roots, rhetorically at least, with the Reagan administration. It continued with Clinton, but No Child Left Behind really brought this to life. And then, of course, under Obama, you have Race to the Top. And moving us even more towards high-stakes testing is a very, as you pointed out, it's a very different role that the federal government has played when you compare it to the from the 50s to the 80s, right? Which is much more about ensuring that we're addressing issues of diversity equity. Now we're actually kind of telling states what to teach, how to measure, whether or not that's been taught. And I think that it is not surprising that when Congress reauthorized ESEA, that was one of their kind of points of obsession, was really recognizing that maybe the federal government has gone too far in the direction of high-stakes testing. We need to change that.
Kevin Kumashiro says we're still in this period of standards and high-stakes testing, not just in the United States, but around the world.
Globally, this is what's happening in education, right? High-stakes testing, narrowing the curriculum, marketizing and privatizing education, all of these things are interlinked not only here in the United States, but around the world as we look at what some of the trends are. There's a point of hope, which is that communities and the professions are really fighting back against a lot of these changes. A few years ago, when the Chicago Teachers Union went on strike, it got a lot of national attention. But what was interesting was, at that very moment, in half a dozen countries around the world, there were other very high-profile professional actions going on by teachers, not who were fighting over their contracts, but who were fighting to push back against these really problematic reforms coming down the pipe that they were saying were making it impossible to really teach.
In other countries, these reforms went beyond high-stakes standardized tests. As the global recession sank in, governments had less money for public resources and faced pressure to privatize their education systems. Private companies offered to partner with public schools or offer low-fee public education. Some also saw education as a market that they could extract profit from. In the United States, wealthy individuals and foundations directed similar efforts at states and local school districts.
We're going to see not only pushes to expand school choice and voucher programs, but more specifically, I also think we're going to see a push to liberalize our ability to charterize a district. In other words, to convert a whole bunch of neighborhood public schools into charter schools. Donald Trump was calling to expand school choice by diverting a lot of money into vouchers. Betsy DeVos is known for really spearheading the voucher reform initiatives in Michigan. And what we're hearing is that There's a series of research reports that was released in the last year and a half that actually tells us that in states where they're experimenting with voucher programs, we now have some very recent and rich data that shows that students who took advantage of the vouchers actually, in many instances, were performing less well. They were getting less education than students in the regular neighborhood public schools. So the idea that everything will improve if you can just treat it like a marketplace where competition is going to drive innovation and hard work, that is not just an objective truth. That actually is an ideology. It's rooted in what's called neoliberal ideology, right? That marketplaces solve all of our problems. You know, the reality is competition sometimes does make us work harder, but anyone who's been in a classroom will know that sometimes competition can so get in the way of learning, and cooperative learning can actually make a really big difference.
That was Dr. Kevin Kumashiro in conversation with Making Contact producer Marie Che. Kumashiro is the former Dean of Education at the University of San Francisco and founder of Education Deans for Justice and Equity. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. To find out more about the people and organizations in today's program, check out our website at radioproject.org. Contributing producers were Hannah Harris-Green and Marie Che. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Staff producers are Anita Johnson, Marie Che, and RJ Lozada. Sabine Blazin is our audience engagement director, and our development associate is Vera Tykulsker. I'm Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Steve Early Lecture, taking place Sunday, March 19th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book regarding the transformation of Richmond, California, from a fossil fuel-dominated town to one of the most progressive cities on the West Coast. Again, that's Steve Early, Sunday, March 19th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church,